Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott. This is Welcome to Florida. Last week, to start the show, we talked about the passing of Bob Graham and his environmental record as Florida's governor and then a U.S. senator. Craig, you followed that conversation up with your Florida Phoenix column, talking more about how this guy whose brothers are developers, whose family was in the sugar industry, became an environmentalist.
Yeah, he didn't start from the right place, but he certainly ended up there. But that, you know, and so my column is about the environmental education of Bob Graham. And it, you know, with a lot of people, it's hard to specifically pinpoint one event that changes things. But for him, it was the publication of the 1981 Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. Yes, I know how weird that sounds, but, you know, this is Florida. The 1981 Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue had Christy Brinkley on the cover posing on Captiva Beach. So, you know, hey, it's a big boon to tourism for Florida. But then on page 29, there's the start of this very powerful, in-depth story about how Florida was screwing up its environment and was circling the drain, and quoted lots of frustrated environmentalists, including Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, Charles Lee of the Audubon Society, and a guy named Johnny Jones from the Florida Wildlife Federation, complaining that he thought Graham was spending too much time running for president to do his job. Does that sound familiar? And saying, I had the biggest conservation organization in Florida, and I can't get in to see him as governor. He ain't got it. And so the day the publication hit the newsstands, Jones calls up a gubernatorial aide named Estes Whitfield, who wound up working for I think five Florida governors over the next 20 years, and tells Whitfield, hey, you better go get a copy of that. And so Whitfield goes out to the newsstand, buys a copy, because that's what people did back then, and then takes it to the 7:30 a.m. staff meeting in Graham's office the next day. And while the other department heads are going around, he's sitting there flipping through the magazine. And when it's his turn, he says, Governor, I got something to show you. The good news is on the cover. The bad news starts on page 29. And he takes it to him. And Graham, who's, you know, a really smart guy, Harvard grad, and so forth, flips through it, speed reads through it, and then says, Estes, please stay after the meeting. And you're thinking, oh my God, he's going to chew my head off. But instead, he basically said, what can we do to fix this? How can we deal with this? I want to do what's right for Florida. And they started working on producing and these amazing programs. He co-founded the Save the Manatee Club. They announced the start of the Save Our Rivers and Save Our Coast program that saved thousands of acres of land. He announced the Save Our Everglades program that wound up starting the restoration of the Kissimmee River. And then it eventually led to the 1985 Growth Management Act. I mean, it was just an incredible string of success.
So many lessons here about politicians, the way we want them to be, right?
Yeah.
For starters, it wasn't lip service. He didn't just throw a couple of dollars at it. He didn't hold a press conference. He didn't commission a study. He did real work. He said, okay, I'm going to do something about this, and it's not going to be easy, and it wasn't what I campaigned on, and he actually did the work, and he was not so dogmatically entrenched to an opinion that he could not admit he was wrong or see that, you know what, this is a good idea. And boy, get our
the contrast
governor
to change
his mind on something, right? Yeah. As if it has become a philosophy of politicians that this is what I am. It's fixed in concrete, and it's some sort of loss or weakness
to back down,
or go in a different direction, or to see things in a different way, or say, yeah, you know what,
or listen to your
critics. I've awoken. I'm right.
Yeah. Oh no, can't be woke. But so I just thought that was an important lesson for everybody to say, you know, Bob Graham,
totally.
listen to his critics. He built bridges. He worked across the aisle with the other party to get these things done, because the goal was to save Florida, save what was important about Florida. Right. And in the process, saved himself as well. And I think that was a big reason he was so popular. He never lost an election.
And that's what he's largely remembered for now. I mean, he's being praised because of something that he really wasn't all that into to begin with. Mm-hmm. What a remarkable story there. And these details get fleshed out in Craig's Florida Phoenix column, floridaphoenix.com. All right. We have done episodes on a number of Florida's great authors. Of course, Craig being one of them, knows these folks, but from Carl Hiaasen to Jack Davis to Dave Barry, Randy Wainwright, we've had episodes on Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas in the past. We had a book ban episode recently, yes, which leads us into today's guest, New York Times bestselling author, Time 100, 100 Most Influential People for 2024, Gainesville resident, Lauren Groff.
She's amazing. And I actually met her at a book event for her book, Florida, which was a collection of short stories. And she has there's a panther on the cover. And so I was joking with her that for my panther book, we were just going to take the same cover and turn the panther around. But ultimately, she gave me a blurb for that book, which I think is wonderful. And what she's doing now, starting this bookstore, is just an amazing thing, and shows her level of commitment to free expression. And yeah, that's why I wanted to talk to her about all
that. A link to the bookstore is in the show notes, along with all of her books for purchase. Here we go with Lauren Groff.
Lauren, thank you so much for joining us today. I've really been looking forward to this. And you've had a couple of surprise honors in the past week or so. You were named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People. And then you got a shout out from Florence Welch on the Taylor Swift song about Florida. How is this all happening right now? And did you actually hear personally from Florence Welch, or are you now being followed by Swifties? Or
oh my gosh, no. Well, so it's such a delight. Right now, I'm actually in New York City for the Time Gala, which is happening tonight, which is very exciting. That was a total surprise. And but that's a collective effort. The Links is a collective effort. So I'm accepting it on behalf of the entire store and everyone who is involved in it. But the Swiftie thing, oh my gosh, that's really astonishing. I did know that Florence had read my books because she's a giant reader, and we have a mutual friend who keeps giving her my books. And I keep signing them over to her, but I had no idea. If you listen to the lyrics are actually pretty astonishingly close to one of my stories called Eyewall, where, you know, she takes a bottle of wine and is sitting in the bathtub and all of her ghosts come to visit her.
Yeah.
It's pretty exciting. I don't think the Swifties have found me yet, but I welcome them when they do.
Maybe some royalty checks too.
Great, but you know, I didn't write any of the words.
So yes, yeah. Well, so I read in the piece of yours that's published in the new Florida Humanities book, Once Upon a Time in Florida, that you initially resisted the allure of Florida when you and your husband settled here. You were like, nope, not gonna buy in. No,
massively. And I think it's because there is this ingrained snobbery in the Northeast. I'm from upstate New York, and even when I was growing up, Florida was the bonkers place of Disney and plastic and spring break, right? I mean, that's sort of the stereotype that I'd been given and that I had accepted. And I did not want to live among palmetto bugs, right? I did not want to live in a place where, you know, armadillos existed. But I slowly actually become a super fan of Florida, the state itself, and a lot of the people in it. So I've gone completely 180 degrees from where I started.
What turned you around?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, it was actually, believe it or not, it was reading a book. Like, so this is my entree into the whole world, right? Is I first understand anything by reading. So I read The Yearling by Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings way at the beginning of starting to live here. And the way she's also a carpetbagger in some ways, right? She was not originally from Florida, but she writes so astonishingly beautifully of the nature of the scrub and of the young boy and his love for being out there, even though it's a hard scrabble life. You know, it's just a gorgeous book. And there are these passages, these very long passages, of just nature description, because she was profoundly in love with that as well. And it was through her eyes first that I found the natural aspect of the state strange and compelling and alien and so extraordinary. And then, you know, we live very close to Payne's Prairie, which is one of my favorite places on the planet. And going out there over and over again, day after day, seeing the micro changes that happen, because we do have seasons in Florida. They just happen much faster and much more subtly than they do up north. Mm-hmm. But seeing all that happen, seeing the way that the, you know, alligators came out at about this time every year, the sandhill cranes coming down, that made me fall head over heels in love with Florida. Also, to be honest, the springs are the best part of Florida, right? And we're really close to the springs. I love them so much. And I think that, you know, they're kind of a hidden attribute of the state that is just, it's the best part. It's so, they're so magnificent and otherworldly, and you can feel yourself in the time of the dinosaurs, right? When you go floating down the Itchituckney. There's so much nature, and it was the nature that made me turn into the state and made me sort of become a Floridian.
In your book Fates and Furies, one of the characters is a mermaid from Wikiwachi Springs. How much research did you do? As in, how many of the mermaid shows did you go see while we were working? Fun.
Yeah, so I wrote an article for the Oxford American a number of years ago. I don't even remember when it was, but it was like, it was right? This is old Florida in a way that's just delightful and charming and strange. And that someone had this idea and now it's a state park, right? So the mermaids are actually state employees. I think that's really wonderful, right?
Yes.
I enjoyed the hell out of it, right? I enjoyed so much watching these normal, ordinary women suddenly become goddesses underwater, holding their breath and breathing out of conch shells and swimming among the fishes in these springs. It really is a flashback to the 1960s, it feels, when you're sitting there watching. And
yeah,
it's very innocent in a way that a lot of entertainment is now far more cynical than the Wikiwachi mermaids. I just loved it. I loved everything about it.
There are many things we spend our tax dollars on I'm not happy about. I'm happy about that we're spending money on waterproof lipstick and shell bras for the mermaids at Wikiwachi Springs.
You moved here with your husband in 2006, but his family's longtime Florida, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, his father came down in 1930 to go to the University of Florida on a track scholarship.
Oh, wow.
But of course, 1932, the Depression hit and all of the track scholarships were removed and he couldn't afford even to go back north. He had no money whatsoever. So he started selling books out of his dorm room. And eventually that became the first Florida bookstore on University Avenue in Gainesville. And, Clay, my husband, is a third generation Floridian.
Wow. Yeah. And now have both of your children been born here as
they,
well?
They are definitely. they love it so much. We spent 6 months in Berlin last year and all they wanted to do was come back to Florida.
So they were like, we want cockroaches to play with or...
There's like the little like the lizards out in the
oh,
park.
Yeah. Oh,
you
yeah.
put them on your ears like earrings, right?
Yes.
They get down. Yeah.
Yeah. Those are Florida kids, definitely.
You talk about spending all that time in Berlin. You know, you're in New York for the Time Awards. Clearly you travel widely and globally. What is the reaction now when you tell people you live in Florida?
Well, you know, I think we have not yet reached the stage where people have started to see beyond the stereotypes, unfortunately, right? So I think there's a real flattening of what the state is in the world imagination. I think a lot of people see it as, you know, Mar-a-Lago and Disney World. That's what it is to a lot of people. And I mean, that is a reality. You both know Florida has billions of realities. We are a monkey bread state. I think, Craig, you and I think all storytellers who love the state, we are all invested in trying to change that very flat stereotype and blow air into it and sort of make it into something complicated and unusual and strange. And not strange in the direction that is sort of commonplace, but sort of expanding or trying to expand what people think of when they think of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Were you trying to do that when you wrote the stories that were in your book, Florida? Did you specifically have in mind, I'm going to change the stereotype, or was that sort of a corollary to what
I do hope that, you know, that's what literary fiction tries to do. It's to sort of like populate stereotypes with things that feel non-stereotypical. It wasn't intentional, but I do think, I mean, I think that's what exposure to other ideas does, right? That's why it's so important, right? I mean, I think every time you look in depth and with attention at any subject or any person, you're going to start to see layers that were profoundly unexpected to you. It's just because of the quality of attention. Attention is so magnificent and rich. It starts to bring out shadows and textures that you had no idea even existed there, right? That's the purpose of close attention, right? That's the purpose of looking at the Panthers in the state of Florida and seeing the way that they've been genetically estranged from themselves for a very long time and sort of tracking the way they came back the way that you did, right? I mean, sort of finding the story and making the story sort of blow up into a different kind of heat, a different kind of fire in the minds of people who read your story. I think, yeah, that's the purpose of it. So even though I wasn't intentionally trying to do that when I wrote Florida, now I think it is a job of a storyteller, every storyteller.
Well, there is a story in that, I have to ask you this, where the narrator walks around the neighborhood at night and looks in people's windows. What reaction did you get from your neighbors when that one was published?
Okay, well, I do have some neighbors who are not quite sure what fiction is. But there was definitely some alarm. I remember an email that went out. I live in this area of Gainesville called the Duck Pond. And an email went out to the entire Duck Pond that's like, it said something about, you know, there are people walking around looking in your windows. You may want to invest in curtains, right? Like very, very angrily. And I would say, right, I don't know if you take nighttime walks, but I do anywhere I am. And that is one of the great glories of taking a nighttime walk in Berlin, right? In Paris, right? In Gainesville, Florida, is actually being able to take a glimpse inside someone else's life and have this fleeting connection to someone else's reality and then walk away, right? I mean, that's just the beauty of walking at night. It's not, you know, my particular, like, I'm not a voyeur.
I heard your mailman actually said something to you about it.
He did. I know. We no longer have that mailman. I wasn't...
Well, your other exciting news is the opening of your new bookstore, The Lynx, there in Gainesville. Just opened. I mean, we're talking days ago as we record now. Why do this?
That's okay. So when I told Ann Patchett that I was going to do it, she said, you fool, exclamation point. I'm so proud of you, right? So very foolish thing.
That's encouraging.
I know, and that's from Anne, because Parnassus is doing really well. So I started to feel a little afraid. Actually, Emma Straub, who's another writer, has this amazing bookstore in Brooklyn called Bookstore Magic, also tried to talk me out of it. So like a lot of people are... but to be perfectly honest, Clay's from a bookstore family. We've talked about doing this for a long time, but we just never really found a place. We were actively looking, but I don't know if that ever would have happened if there hadn't been the recent sort of avalanche of book challenges and book bannings that are happening in Florida that are deeply embarrassing Florida to the rest of the country and the rest of the world. So a lot of this started when I was in Berlin. Germans were like, you have to stop it now, because we know what happens when book bans become book burnings. So there's this amazing poet, German poet named Heinrich Heine, and he has this extraordinary quote, which I'm not going to butcher in German, but it said, in places where people burn books, people will one day burn people. And I believe that is absolutely the case, right? And book bannings is the first step toward book burnings. So we have to check this authoritarian slide into Inferno. We have to sort of push back. And so Clay and I really, what other power do we have except that of citizens and that of possible business owners? And as business owners, as the owner of a small independent bookstore, we can make available a lot of the books that are being challenged in libraries and schools, right? Because they are governed by the state of Florida. We are not governed by the state of Florida. This is a private enterprise. And so we can celebrate the voices that are being squelched and being tamped down. We can bring light to a lot of the ideas that are being pushed to the side. We can tell people that their lives have great meaning when the state of Florida is invested in telling them that they have no meaning. So really, we see this bookstore as a lighthouse, right? We want to just spread the light of tolerance. We want to spread the light of free expression. We want to tell people who are stuck in families, in counties, where they're not free to be their own people. We want to tell them that it's okay. There are other people like them and there are safe places for them. And we are a safe place for them. So That's the reason. I'm very passionate about this, as you can tell.
Well, and that's wonderful.
Yeah.
The three of us are writers, obviously. You know, you have an incredible platform. You can open a bookstore, but a lot of people, you know, just the people listening to this podcast, you know, you're facing an authoritarian regime with Ron DeSantis and the legislature, and we all wrestle in our own, what can I do? How can I help? You know, you can open a bookstore. You know, the three of us are writers. We can write about and highlight. We can do this podcast, Craig and I, you know, but, you know, ordinary people, I think, can read. You know, you can read these books, you can open your mind, you can educate yourself, and most importantly, everyone can vote.
Yes. And I don't know if you have these amazing little free libraries around, but
we can
these little free libraries with a lot of these books, right? That's one of our plans when we're really fully launched and off the ground. We want to sort of seed a lot of these dangerous books into little libraries all over the place.
Well, wait now. You're selling books, but you're also going to give away books? That seems like a problem for the business model.
Right? I know, but I want to be the Dolly Parton of Florida.
What a great aspirational goal.
Yeah, there you go. Wow. That'll go into full quotes. When you're doing your banned book section, how huge does it have to be? I mean, because in Florida, there have been objections to everything from Toni Morrison to And Tango Makes Three and Amanda Gorman's poem for the inauguration. I mean, it's just such a wide range of things. Even Bill O'Reilly got canceled and was finally got upset about everything else.
Yeah, no, so we're actually going to highlight specific books. You know, we're going to actually sort of make sure that everyone knows the top 10 books that are currently being banned. Of course, we can't have the dictionary, right? We can't have
that's right. Dictionary and the encyclopedia are on the list too. Yeah.
So bizarre. You know, there's so many books in Florida that have been challenged. We don't have a shelf for 2,300 books, but we do have outfacing shelves that are, as soon as you enter the bookstore, we have a screen that sort of flashes through a lot of the banned books. And we have two shelves that are just full with outfacing banned books, just to tell you face out as soon as you come in, this is what's important to us. And a lot of these books are amazing and you're going to love them.
Yeah. And you're also emphasizing Florida authors. Who are some who are some that you're displaying?
Oh my gosh. For everyone. I mean, you, right?
Thank you.
David Levitt, Amy Hempel, Patricia Engel, Edwidge Danticat, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, Marjorie Kennan Rawlings. I mean, we have so many. That's the other thing. So, you know, I secretly, and I don't know if everybody else in the bookstore even knows this about the sort of push for Florida literature, but I do believe that if we as a state have more pride in our culture, right, in our cultural exports and the things that other people in other places are reading, we're going to have more pride in who we are, right? It's part of the myth-making experience to sort of buy into and to feel true delight in all of these books, all of these movies, all of these cultural products that are coming out of this extraordinary state. And so I do think that the store can act as an ambassador and say that there are wonderful things coming out of the state. There's arts coming out of the state. We are not the stereotypical place that you think we are.
That's a good point.
When I travel and talk to people about Florida, and you mentioned, oh, you love the Springs and Payne's Prairie and Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings, and these are sort of the stories you'd like to highlight beyond, you know, Disney and South Beach. I always go to arts and culture. Like, oh, but let me tell you now. Let me tell you about all these incredible authors. Let me tell you about the contemporary art scene in Miami. Let me tell you about St. Pete and what's going on there. Let me tell you about the Miami Book Fair, the largest single site of Frank Lloyd Wright architecture in the country. You know, you talk about the flattening out of a story. That's what's going on. You know, Florida. Broadly, Florida tourism just decided we're going to be weather and recreation and cheap real estate. Everything else is going to be put to the side, and that's what we're going to sell ourselves on. And it sells ourselves so remarkably short. And that's one of the reasons we do this podcast, is to highlight all of these incredible aspects of Florida. I go to the civil rights history all the time. You know, the incredible civil rights. We just did an episode on A. Philip Randolph, the civil rights leaders, Augusta Savage, who came out of it. It's the tip of the iceberg is the mouse ears, but you know, that's what everyone sees, I guess.
Right. Thank you for doing this work. Right. You are actively changing people's conception of this state. You are expanding it. You're making it spiky. You're making it strange. And I love that stuff. I mean, this is why we're doing this work right now.
I have to ask you this question because I read it in a New York Times profile and I couldn't believe it. You work on several books at once. How do you do that? I thought maybe you were pulling the reporter's leg. I was like, no, that can't be possible.
No, so I do, but it's because of my own deep flaws as a human being, right? So I have OCD. I am obsessive compulsive about a lot of things. And if I allow myself to be compulsive, like obsessively into a single project at once, I freeze and I cannot get through it. Because everything is riding on that one project. I can't function as a writer or as a thinker when all the pressure is on one thing. So to take that pressure off, I do have multiple stations in my office where I go to work on this one thing. I mean, I have probably four or five things I've been working on. One of them I will never finish, and I know, right? Like I won't. But if that's where the joy is that particular day, right? If that's where the energy is, if that's what's leading me to actually be excited about coming to the page, that's where I'm going to go. Even if I know for a fact it's never going to be done. So it's a function of just getting through my own internal resistance to having something perfect, having one particular perfect thing, and opening up avenues of joy and pleasure, because we don't talk about this enough, but making things should be pleasurable, right? It doesn't mean that there aren't moments of pain. Of course there are, but if your only experience of it is pain, maybe we should do something else, right? Like maybe move on to something that's just fun, right? Or just joyous. Maybe it doesn't have to come into the world. Maybe the act of creation is enough. And I believe it is. Yeah.
But so how are you going to fit that in with running a bookstore?
Yeah.
Simultaneously.
I am not alone in the bookstore. And this is the thing that is the very best. My partner is my husband, and he's very, very good at all sort of like the systems things. But we made knock on wood, but it has been so far the very, very, very best choice we have made. We hired two managers. One, Jackie Davidson, does all the operations. So the ordering, the returning, all those things, and scheduling. And then Gina Marks, who's our events and community relations person. And part of her job really is collaborating with other nonprofits and businesses and really strengthening, right? So we're not strong alone. We're only strong when we have other people holding us up. And so we definitely, the store's name is The Lynx. There's a pun there. It's not just the amazing wildcat. It's also We are the link, right? We want to be the link. We want to be a cultural link. We want to be an artistic link. We want to be a literary link. We want to be a social justice link, right? We want to bring people and organizations together to make Gainesville stronger, to make Florida stronger, to make us all, every single community that relies on us, stronger. So luckily, I don't have to run the store because I have people running the store, and I get to come in and be like, oh, we should put flowers here. You need to order these 1,000 books, right? So my job will be more joyous, I think, and they get to run everything.
Have you talked with Florida's other big celebrity bookstore owner, Judy Blume?
Oh boy, have I. Yes, I have. I know. I love that woman. And she goes in every day. I don't know how old she is. I think she's 80.
But something like that.
Every day in her little kitten heels. I can't believe she can even walk on them. And she squeegees the windows and she shelves the books. And like, she's just awesome, right? She's there for the love of books and for the joy of it. And speaking of banned books, her books are the OG banned book, right?
Yeah.
Back in the day, she had to go before Congress to defend her book's right to be in the world. So she is an astonishment. I really love that woman.
Yeah.
Looping back to the banned book topic, and you know, I was, you know, this is hardly controversial to say I was against banned books, but it previously it was always on a macro level, this idea of free speech and, you know, attacks on intellectualism, very, very focused on society as opposed to the individual. Only recently have I come to understand how devastating these bans can be on individual people, not a state, not a country, because I'm white, I'm male, I'm able-bodied, I'm heterosexual, I'm middle-classed. Everything about this country is designed for me to make me feel comfortable by people who look like me. I've never felt awkward or out of place or like any space was not hospitable to me. But if you're queer, but if you're Black, but if you're an immigrant, but if you're poor, those are the sort of stories that are being banned. And if you fall into one of those groups, one book, one TV show, one artwork can make such a difference as being this life preserver among a society that has all its rifles aimed at you to say, but there are other people out there like this, experiencing this. I can get through one more day thanks to this book. And that, to me, it's a massive societal problem, but it's the individuals, those people who are targeted everywhere, that are especially targeted in these book bans.
That's an amazing point, and that was so beautifully said. And the truth is, I mean, the kids whose families can afford to come to my bookstore probably are not going to be affected by these book bans. Yeah. But the kids who are relying on their schools, on their libraries, to find books that reflect them back, that reflect, say, Black history into the world, they're not finding them there. Mm. It's devastating. So yes, this bookstore is a lighthouse, but what we really, really want to do is bring people together to rise up as a larger voice and say, this child who has been trans since they were born has a right to read what they want to read in their school library, if it's going to make them feel less under the pressure, right? Less picked on by the state of Florida. Right, that's the thing that is egregious, that the state of Florida is actually actively going after people. That's just terrifically awful.
Right, and it's easy for a 40-year-olds like us to give the middle finger and at Florida and the legislature and DeSantis and say, bite this. But if you're 12,
right,
and you don't, and you know, you're an immigrant and you don't speak the language, maybe great anyways. And, you know, all of the, and you're hungry because you're poor and your parents are always out of the house because they got to work too. You look at the state and you say, this, I am not welcome here. So you don't value yourself because you're not part of the set of people that are valued.
Right. Correct. Yes. Yeah. Right. These book bans do more than just take individual books out of the hands of people. They have a profound chilling effect on everyone, right? So yeah. I have a friend who is as progressive as you get. She's a fifth grade language arts and history teacher, and she used to be able to teach Mouse, this incredible graphic novel about the Holocaust.
Oh, right? By Art Spiegelman, yes.
Yes, by Art Spiegelman. It's an amazing book, and she taught it as their first introduction to what the Holocaust was. She no longer can put that book on her shelves, right? Because she is so afraid of the parents, even though, you know, in our county, the book has not been banned. She sees that she might get into trouble if she does. So it's not just like the individual books, it's the massive chilling effect that it's having on free speech, even before these books get banned in particular counties. Yeah. It's really, really egregious, and it's spreading, and it's mostly, it's two or three people doing this to the vast majority. And a tiny, tiny minority of people actually want to take these books out of people's hands. It's so frustrating.
And most of them, they haven't read.
No, of course not. Yeah.
Because, you know, oh my gosh, that would, you know, mess my mind up. My last question, this is the question every writer hates to hear, but what are you working on now? What's next after Matrix, which was amazing, and Vaster Wilds, which I have not read yet. I'm sorry, but I'll get to it. What's next? Is it a trilogy or?
Yeah, Matrix and the Vaster Wilds and a third book I wrote all at the same time. And I sort of dumped them on my editor and public and agent's lap. And I was like, here you go. And ran away crying. first two, as sort of like a very loose triptych over about 1,000 years, 800 years. And I just wanted to be a stone skipping across the water to sort of see the way that things like nature and the way that society treats women and God and religion, all of these things that are circling together, bring us to where we are now at the like absolute cusp of climate apocalypse, right? We're right there. So that's the larger idea of this project. Of course, the third book has proven so incredibly difficult to write. It may just be a diptych, and that's totally fine too. Like, but I'm also working on that one thing that'll never be finished ever. I'm working on a short story collection. I'm working on a couple of other novels. So we'll see.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I loved Matrix. If you had told me 6 months ago that, oh, hey, you're going to read this book about a 14th century nun and you're going to be blown away by it, I would have said, no, that's not my cup of tea. But it was great. It was awesome.
Thank you.
Last one for me, and then we'll let you go. And we really appreciate it. Books matter. Bookstores matter. But why especially do independent bookstores like yours matter?
I love the
communities.
This.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, right. They're the central nexus of any town. The booksellers know you. They know the taste of the town. They care so deeply because they're embedded in the town. And 50, I think, in a chain, 13% of the money goes back into the town. In an independent bookstore, 53% of the cash spent at the store will go back into the town. So it's strengthening the community in every possible direction, right? It's bringing books together. It's bringing ideas into the community. I think an independent bookstore really is the heart of a town. We had a very tiny one up until May 4th. Third House is, yeah. I love them so much. They're great. Heather has decided to go to a non-brick and mortar format, which I think will be great for her. Gainesville hasn't had a larger independent bookstore in a very long time. And I'm
Gehrings. It was Gehrings, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Gehrings. Yeah. And I loved Gehrings. And I was so devastated when it was gone. We do have Book Gallery West. We do have Book Gallery West. Yes, they're great. They don't do events, right? And I think one of the things about an independent bookstore is like they push really hard to do a lot of author events to get, you know, the
and book and book clubs too. Yeah.
And book clubs. Yes. And
totally,
that's so
totally
important.
Yeah. Yeah. Here where I live in Fernandina Beach, a local bookstore opened sometime during the pandemic and it has become the go-to. Well, that's where Craig signed.
You story came and song. And
story and song. And
oh God, I love story and song. Oh my God.
The book talk. And it's become a great community space. I'm there every, you know, few months for some organization or other, most of them having nothing to do with literature. You know, it's just an organizational community space that is a real boon to getting people together. What a great thing.
That's right. That's right. Also, when next time you go in, tell them I love them so much.
I will do that. I will do that for sure. They'll probably put a quote up on the wall from you. All right. Lauren Groff, thank you so much to the new bookstore, The Links in Gainesville. I've got a link to that.
Link to The Links.
Hey, yeah. Link to The Links in the show notes, along with all the books, which are everywhere. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lauren.
My pleasure. Thank you both. I really appreciate it. It
was lovely. All right.
Yeah, the local, we all remember You've Got Mail, right? The book, Hanks, Meg Ryan. Tom Hanks runs the big corporate bookstore, and he's going to push out Meg Ryan, the local book. But, you know, that movie was 20 years ago. It seems like local bookstores, you know, it's anecdotal, but, you know, they're kind of coming back.
Indies are doing quite well. My local one, Tombolo Books, they started right before the pandemic began, so you'd think, oh my god, they're doomed, but they coped with it. The owners actually went out and delivered books by bicycle during the pandemic. Amazing. While the bookstore was closed, and people responded, and they're doing lots of community events and have become sort of a force in the community now here in St. Petersburg. So I'm my hat's off to all the indies.
Right, Tombolo there in St. Pete, Story and Song up by me on Fernandina, Books and Books in Miami. You talked about Judy Blume's. So, I mean, they're out there. You got to go a little bit off the beaten path to find them. But I always, they're fascinating places when you go inside. They have such a pulse of the community. And anywhere I try and visit, you know, if you want to get a feel for a place, we've talked about this in the Orlando episode different times. Boy, go to the local bookstore. You will get an understanding of the town real quick.
And the folks that work there are always really interesting and fairly lively and have some pretty good opinions too.
Absolutely.
So, you know, ask your bookstore clerk what's going on, and they can let you in on it.
Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.